Now let's go on to the Dayenu portion. If you have this Haggadah, it's on page 38, otherwise you'll have to find your own. The Dayenu portion. The heading of it is Kama Ma'alot Tovot Lamakom Aleinu. Look how many favors that God did to us. Remember, we are describing the Exodus. So we say, look how many favors God did to us. Ilu hotzianu mitzrayim. Let's say that he would have taken us out of Egypt. Velo asa bahem shfatim. And he wouldn't have done anything to the Egyptians. Dayenu would be sufficient, which is, it's not absolutely necessary for the Exodus to be associated with the punishment of the Egyptians. And then he goes on. And if he would have punished the Egyptians, but not their gods, or their gods, but not their firstborn, but not their property. What about if he would have given us their property, right? The gold and silver that the Egyptians gave the Jews, and he wouldn't have split the sea to be sufficient. What about if he would have split the sea, but we wouldn't be able to walk on the dry land? It would also be sufficient. And so on and so forth. What's the idea behind it? There are certain ones that really require an explanation. What does it mean? To thank that, let's say God would have split the sea, but it wouldn't have been dry, right? So it would have been muddy. So how come we have to say that? How come we have to mention that? Or what about if he would have given us the manna, but he wouldn't have given us the Sabbath? Let's say he would have given us the Sabbath, and then we wouldn't have gone to Mount Sinai, because you know that the Sabbath was given before Mount Sinai. What about if he would have been by Mount Sinai, but God wouldn't have given us the Torah? As if being by Mount Sinai would have any value without the giving of the Torah. What does it mean exactly? So the idea behind this portion is the following. We know that the basis of our commitment to God is appreciation. It says in many, many places that the fact that we have a commitment to God that no one else has is because we owe it to Him. Right? This is how God starts His statement on Mount Sinai. What's the first statement of God on Mount Sinai? Which means, what is the basis for the commitment? That I took you out of Egypt. You owe me. You owe me something that other creatures don't owe me. Because if everybody would owe me, then everybody would be obligated to keep 613 commandments. Which means everybody owes me something because I've created them. But as a creature, you only owe me 7 commandments. You only have to fulfill 7 basic principles to be a decent human being. But you Jews owe me more. Your commitment is deeper. It's more intense because I took you out of Egypt. So therefore, without me, you would have been a slave. So you owe me your freedom. Right now. Since we know then that the basis of our commitment to God is because we owe it to Him, then the more we realize how much appreciation we are supposed to have to God, the more commitment there is. Obviously, if our commitment is dependent on what we owe Him, then the more we appreciate what He did for us, the more commitment we have, obviously. Now, in order to appreciate something, it's important that you should break up the favor that you receive to its minimum elements. Like for instance, let's say you eat something by someone. So you can say, thank you, you gave me food, thank you very much. But what about if you want to show a greater sense of gratitude? Then you say, well, it's not only that you gave me the food. You went to the store and you bought the food and you cooked the food. And then you put it on the plate, and then you brought it to me. I mean, it's all one thing. It's giving me food. But the moment I break it up into its minimal elements, then it shows that I have a greater appreciation. Now, if you pay attention here, you will find that we break up the one act. Basically, it's one thing. God took us out of Egypt and brought us into Israel. That's basically what God did to us. But we try to break it up to its 15 minimal elements. And if you take a look, there are 15. There are 15 points that we make, 15 elements that we find. And the commentaries say, why 15 elements? Why not 14 or 16? Obviously, it's not a coincidence. And the commentaries say, because there are 15 steps leading to the temple. Now, the temple was built that way, that there were 15 steps leading to the upper level of the temple, 15 steps. And on each step, when they would go up, they would sing a Shir Hama'alos. And the chapter in Tehillim, Shir Hama'alos, what does the title mean? Shir, the song, Hama'alos. What is a ma'ala? A step. And you know how many there are? 15, obviously, because there are 15 steps. Okay? So the idea is that your road, your path towards commitment, because going up to the temple symbolically means commitment, closeness to God, there are 15 steps on the road of closeness to God. And each one of the steps that you take requires a new condition, which is a new appreciation. Remember, commitment, the prerequisite of commitment is appreciation. If God wants us to commit ourselves on Mount Sinai, He says, I'm God, your God, who took you out of Egypt. So therefore, since there are 15 levels of commitment, there must be 15 elements in the appreciation. Therefore, the author of the Haggadah breaks up the one act of taking us out of Egypt and giving us Israel into 15 steps of appreciation. This is the meaning of this Dayan. What? Exactly. As a matter of fact, this is what the commentaries say. The whole Haggadah, which is just a method of the realization of coming closer to God, if you really count, there are 15 steps, even though in many of the Haggadot you will find 14, it's a mistake. They count Motzi and Matzah as one, usually, when in reality those are two steps, those are two blessings. So really there are 15 steps right in the beginning. I don't want to go into it, but take a look in your own Haggadot, and sometimes you will find 14. It's only because of that, because by mistake they counted together Motzi, which is one blessing, Hamotzi Lechem in Haaretz, and Matzah, which is a completely different blessing, there's a completely different steps. And in reality, there are 15 steps, because those are the 15 steps which represent our coming closer to God, our appreciating what God did for us, and therefore our commitment to God. Now take a look at the conclusion of the Dayan, and you'll see clearly that that's the point. You see, right at the paragraph after Dayenu, Alachat kama vekama, right? Which means, a fortiori. I mean, if you owe something to God, if He did you one favor, Alachat kama vekama, so much more so. Tova kfula umechupelet, which means, it's doubled and doubled again and doubled again, the appreciation that we owe God. And then he counts all those steps that we were talking about, the 15 steps. What? No. There are 15 steps. They may be 14 Dayenus, but there are 15 steps. Because the Dayenus just connect one steps with the next. You see? There are 14 times that we say the word Dayenu. But the word Dayenu comes between 1 and 2. Right? So that's, there are two right there. In the first one, there are already two. There are really 15 steps of Dayenu, even though the word Dayenu, right? There. What? What do you mean? No. You can rely on the commentaries. There are 14 Dayenus, but there are 15 steps, right? And the Dayenu just connects one step to the other. Yeah. Exactly, exactly. But we are supposed to bring it out, right? Of course, it's the same example of what I told you, the food. If the lady would have bought the food, but she wouldn't have cooked it, I wouldn't have had any food. But my obligation, as far as the appreciation is concerned, is to break it up to its minimal elements. So of course the elements, without being connected with each other, right, I would get nothing out of it. But once I did get something out of it, I have the obligation to show, to see, right, the minimal elements within the overall picture, right? That shows a greater generosity, which brings about a greater sense of appreciation and commitment. Now, take a look at the next paragraph. Rabban Gamliel Haya Omer. Rabban Gamliel would say, Kol Shelo Amar Shlosha Dvarim Eilu BaPesach. If a person did not say these three things on Passover, Lo Yatza Yedei Chovato, he has not fulfilled completely the obligation of that night. Which means that there is a certain obligation that you don't fulfill unless you explain the three things here. Pesach, Matzah, Umaror. And then we go on. Pesach, why do we eat the Paschal lamb? Shehayu avoteinu ochlim bizman shebeit hamikdash haya kayam al shuma, why do we eat it? And then he goes on. Because God, al shum shepasach hakadosh baruch hu, al batei avoteinu b'mitzrayim. God skipped over the houses of our forefathers. And this is what the word Pesach means. Pesach is pass over, skip over. Next one. Matzah. Why do we eat the matzah? Al shum shelo ispik betzeikam shel avoteinu lehachmit, to remind us of the fact that God rushed us out of Egypt. How? Because when you have plenty of time, you allow the dough to rise. When you don't have time, then you put it in the oven right away. Right? So that's what it's saying. Al shum shelo ispik betzeikam shel avoteinu lehachmit, ad shenigla lehem melech malchei hamlachim hakadosh baruch hu. God was in a rush to take us out of Egypt. And what's so important to remind us, what is so important that to tell us that he was in a rush, to tell us, so to speak, had we stayed any longer, a minute longer, so to speak, we wouldn't have been able to come out. God, it was like an emergency, an urgent situation that God took us out of Egypt at the last possible minute. Right? To remember that the assimilation that we came to, the ideological assimilation, was such that we couldn't have survived any longer without having been taken out. This is what the meaning of the matzah is. Maror ze shanu ochlim al shuma. Why do we eat maror? Al shum shemereru hamitzrim et chaye avoteinu b'mitzrayim. Because the Egyptians made our lives bitter. And we bring the appropriate verse. One very strange thing concerning this particular portion. We know that on the night of Passover, the key number is the number 4. Everything centers around the number 4, right? The 4 cups, the 4 sons, the 4 questions. All of a sudden, we find the number 3 here. Right. Now, in reality, what is it 3 or is it 4? You say, well, what difference does it make? Well, it does make a difference. It does make a difference because we know that numbers are never coincidental. So why all of a sudden here we find the number 3? In the Maharal, we find an insight into numbers in general. What does it say about the number 3? He says that the number 3, always, whenever you find a number 3 in Torah, it represents establishment of something. Establishment, you can even imagine. If you want to set up a table, for instance, if it has 2 legs, it won't stand. You need 3. Anything in order to stand needs 3. And we find it all over throughout the Torah. we find that you want to establish something, you want to establish ownership on a field, let's say, right? And you don't have the document. If you were there for three seasons, here, three, then you have established your ownership. And yeah, I'm sure each one of you can think of some other situation. Oh, right, the three things on which the world stands. Again, three things. Torah, Avodah, Milchazah, three things the world stands. What? Well, no, the three things are Torah, Avodah, Gemilah, Chasadim. You mean that is the three, that's the center of humanity. All right. Or we find, for instance, if those of you learned Baba Kama, you know, the gore, when does it get the title of a gorer? Three times again. So it's not a coincidence at all. Then we talk about who are our patriarchs, the ones who established the Jewish people. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Three, right? So we always find that the number three represents those that establish something. It's on, the support is on three points. The Maharal says, so why are there four matriarchs? Right? Why four? So he gives us the following insight into the number four. He says, three, as we said before, represents support, establishment of something. But whenever we are in a situation when something which is established is in danger of falling, right? So, because there is a strong wind, you have to reinforce it. The reinforcement of it is the fourth leg. So therefore, the four represents the three brought down to reality. Like, for instance, we find consistently that the Ovos, our patriarchs, represent something closer to the ideal. But when that ideal had to come down to the real world, our patriarchs listened to our matriarchs. They were closer to the reality, to practicality. For instance, what did Abram want to do with Ishmael? Keep him at home. Right? Ideally, that's the best, of course. Someone like Ishmael, had he stayed home, of course you can influence him. That is the ideal, that he should stay home, the family should stick together. Sarah, who was closer to the reality of things, what did she say? In reality, just can't work. Right? It can't work. Throw him out. Right? The reality is sad. So, what did we do? What Sarah said, right? In the real world, what Abraham wanted represents what is the ideal. But when the ideal comes down to the reality of things, it changes. Right. Same thing, Isaac and Rebecca, Isaac and Rivka, Yitzhak and Rivka. Yitzhak wants to give the blessing to Esau, to Esau. Because in the ideal world, Esau is supposed to take care of all physical matters. Right? What does Yaakov want? The blessing of Mitala Shamaim, that he should give Mitala Shamaim Umishmane Ares, the fat of the land. Is that ideal for Jacob? That is ideal for Esau, not for Jacob. So ideally, Yaakov is supposed to take care of all spiritual matters, and Esau is supposed to take care of all the physical matters, and they would have created an ideal partnership. This is what Yitzchak thinks, the Yitzchak who represents the ideal. Rivka, what does she say? Sorry, it won't work. In the reality of things, in the real world, Esau and Yaakov can never live together. They have to separate. So who will take care of Yaakov's physical needs? Yaakov himself. He has to steal the blessing. Sure, ideally, it's not his blessing. But in the reality of things, it has to be him. Again, what do we find? The same relationship. Yitzchak represents the ideal, and who brings him down to earth, to reality? Rivka, his wife. The same thing we find between Yaakov and Rochel, right? Who decides, who makes the final decision to help that Yaakov should marry Leah? Rochel is the one that makes the decision. Which means that in the ideal world, Yaakov is supposed to have one wife, Rochel, that's all. But in the real world, Yaakov has a little bit of Esau. Remember, Yaakov just became a little bit of Esau by stealing the blessing. Right? Therefore, he comes to Laban right after that, and he works by Laban. Because once he takes the blessing of Esau, he becomes a little bit of Esau. The good side of Esau, of course, we're not talking the evil of Esau. But even the good side of Esau is very materialistically oriented, focused on the physical. This is what Yaakov becomes by Laban. He's still the Yaakov, the spiritual Yaakov, but there is a new personality in Yaakov. There is a new personality which he gained by taking the blessing of Esau. Right? So that new personality also needs his own soulmate. Who was the soulmate of Esau? You know what the oral tradition says, who is the soulmate of Esau? Leah. So therefore now, according to the real world, Leah needs to become the soulmate of that other side of Yaakov. And it's not a coincidence at all. The same way that he earned that second personality through a trick, right? How does Leah become his wife? Also through a trick, because just to parallel the situation. Which means that in the real world, Yaakov doesn't have to marry Leah. I'm sorry, in the ideal world, Yaakov doesn't have to marry Leah. In the real world, Yaakov has to marry Leah. So whose decision is it? Rochel's. Again, the same idea. The same idea. The reality is always the matriarchs. This is why, says the Maharal, the matriarchs are four. The patriarchs are three. Because the relationship between three and four is, three is to establish something according to its ideal. But when it comes down to reality, you need a fourth leg to the table in order to strengthen the other three. That fourth leg is represented by our matriarchs. They represent the number four to our patriarchs number three. Now, we find then in the Manishtano, right? Remember, the version that we have of the Manishtano is not the original version. The original version of the Manishtano, it's made up of four questions, but different. One of the questions is different. One question was, why do we eat the Paschal lamb, the Korban Pesach? Why do we eat sli, roasted meat? Right? The second one is matzah. Why do we eat matzah? The third one is the bitter herbs. Right? They correspond to what Rabban Gamliel says here, true or not? Remember, according to our version that was changed after the destruction of the temple, we took out the question concerning the Paschal lamb because we stopped doing it, and we substituted it with something else which represents freedom. That is the leaning, the question about the leaning. But the original version did not have the question about the leaning. It had the question concerning the Paschal lamb. So comes out according to this that the three things which Rabban Gamliel says are required in order to fulfill the Seder are already mentioned in the questions. Pesach, Matzah, Umaror. But isn't it strange? We ask a fourth question. Which is the fourth question? The dipping. Here? The dipping. Now, why the dipping? How can we ask the question concerning the dipping? Remember, we spoke about the four questions, we asked, this is the one question which is incongruous, doesn't fit in. Because the three, Pesach, Matzah, Umaror, are all in the Torah. Right? They are all in the Torah. Pesach is in the Torah, Matzah is in the Torah, Maror is in the Torah. Dipping is not in the Torah. It's something which was added by the rabbis. Why do we add that in the four questions? So I told you that the real meaning of the dipping is that without the dipping, the other three have no meaning. You need the dipping to make the other three meaningful. Why? Because what is the symbolism of the dipping? So I told you that one of the commentaries on the 10th perek, the 10th chapter in the tractate Psachim, says that the idea of the dipping, what is it? Remember? It's an appetizer. That's why we dip. We dip because it represents an appetizer. Something that you dip before the meal is an appetizer. It just increases your appetite. And since it's a mitzvah to eat matzah while you are hungry, right? Yep, there is a specific commandment Don't eat on the afternoon on Passover so you can eat the matzah when you're hungry. You have to be hungry to eat the matzah. It's not enough just to eat it. You have to develop a hunger. To eat the appetizer is to develop the hunger. You do something positive. Usually you can do something positive to develop hunger. You just can not eat, which is negative. But by eating the appetizer, you are doing something to show that you want to develop hunger. What is the idea to develop a hunger? Because, says the Maharal of Prague, remember, this night of Passover is the night of contrasts. That's the whole idea of this night. We compare freedom with slavery, nighttime to daytime, happiness with sadness. So, if that's the whole idea, if you want to appreciate food, you have to also develop a sense of its opposite. What is the opposite of the appreciation of food? Hunger. True. So therefore, the appetizer tells you that in order for you to appreciate Pesach, Matzah, Moror, you have to develop an interest in it. This is why you have to ask questions. Remember I told you the statement in the Talmud. Why do we dip, says the Talmud, in order that the children should ask? That's what the Talmud says, which sounds so unusual. What do you mean? We dip in order that we should ask. So it could say, you have to jump up and down 10 times in order that the children should ask. And once they ask, what do you tell them? Why are you doing it, Father? In order that you should ask. So, but why are you doing it? Well, that's all. Okay. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. You have to give him an answer. That's the answer. You know why I do it? Because it represents my desire that you should ask. The same way that in order to appreciate food you have to be hungry, in order to appreciate an answer you have to ask questions. I eat the appetizer to remind you, or to remind me to remind you, that you have to ask before an answer can be given to you. This is why, if you remember the fourth son, when he says he doesn't know how to ask, so it doesn't say, so give him an answer anyway. What does it say? You prod him, right? Inside him, that he should ask the questions. That was make him hungry. Don't give him the answer before he develops the hunger. Okay? Now, that is the reason for the dipping, right? Therefore, you have the three. Pesach, Matzah, Moror represents like the basis of Passover. But the fourth one strengthens the other three. Okay? This is the fourth leg of the table. The dipping is the fourth leg of the table. It's the fourth leg which makes the other legs solid, strong. Okay? Now, if you take a look at Rabban Gamliel's statement, right? Everybody sees the number 3 there. The Maharal of Prague is the number 4 there. Where is there a fourth statement, a fourth thing in what Rabban Gamliel is saying? Well, you see, it doesn't say Rabban Gamliel Omer Pesach Matzu Moror, that is the Ikar HaSeder, the main part of the Seder. It doesn't say that. He says, Kol Shelo Amar Shlosha Dvarim, if he does not say it, he can't fulfill it. So what does he have to do? He has to say it, right? He has to say it. So how many things are there in what Rabban Gamliel says? 4 things. Pesach, Matzah, and Moror, and he has to say it. He has to say it. Now, the saying that represents that, you have to realize what it's all about. Pesach, Matzah, Moror by itself, that's not enough. Because the Pesach, Matzah, Moror has to become a reality in your life. So, you have to say it. That is the fourth leg of the table. So, in reality, when Rabban Gamliel says, Kol Shelo Amar Shlosha Dvarim Elo BaPesach Lo Yatza, he's telling you 4 things. He's telling you Pesach, Matzah, Moror, and remember to say it. Don't rely on just reading it. You have to say it. You have to explain it. You have to understand it. Otherwise, you won't fulfill it at all. So, according to this, it's 100% consistent with the number 4. This is the saying it is the number 4. The complement, that's what complements the number 3. Now, let's go over again this particular piece, Pesach. Pesach, why do we say, why do we eat the Paschal lamb? It says, because God skipped over the Jewish houses. Now, it's interesting. How does the Torah call the holiday? Pesach, huh? Pesach. Well, not really. The Torah doesn't call it Pesach. We call it Pesach. That's the interesting part of it. We call the holiday Pesach. You know what the Torah calls it? Throughout. Chag HaMatzot. Chag HaMatzot, right? Chag HaMatzot. Not Chag HaPesach. It's interesting. Why? Why is it that other holidays, we accept the name that the Torah gave? But Passover, we don't accept the name that the Torah gave. Nobody says, I'm going home for matzah holiday. Right? We say, I'm going home for Passover. Why? Why? Why don't we accept the Torah description of the holiday? And why doesn't the Torah call it Chag HaPesach? Isn't that the most important event that God skipped over? So, there is an answer which is quoted from the main disciple of the Gaon of Vilna. His name was Reb Chaim of Volozhin. And he gives the following answer. Now, the answer, in order to be understood, let me use the following analogy. Just before we go into analogy, by the way, Pesach, what are we focusing on? Pesach, on the fact that God skipped over our houses. Matzos has to do with the fulfillment of the mitzvos. By the way, matzos and mitzvos are spelled the same way. Mem tzadik vov tav. It's not a coincidence. Right. Now, says Reb Chaim of Volozhin, what do you think would be, let's say for instance, you're obligated to honor your parents, right? Let's say your parents come and you ask your parents, what can I serve you? And they say, a glass of water. So if you give them a glass of water, you'll be fulfilling the commandment of honoring your parents, doing what they want. Okay? Now, what about if you say to yourself, yeah, but they, I know, like coffee more than water. But why didn't they tell me to make coffee? They don't want to bother me. Okay? Fine, but I want to bother. So I'll give them coffee. But wait a second. If I give them coffee, I'm not going to be fulfilling what they asked me to do. So you say, well, because they really want coffee. No, it's not true. They really want water because they really don't want to bother me. You hear? So that's a dilemma. What should I do? Right? Should I give them water? Because that's exactly what they want. Right? Again, remember, they are not hypocrites. They are not really saying water because they really want coffee and they want me to give them coffee. No, no, no. They, of course, ideally they would like coffee, but the fact that it's going to bother me that I have to make an effort is a reality to them. It's something that they take in consideration. So they mean it. They would rather drink water, even though they love coffee much more. Says Reb Chaim Volozhin, give them coffee. Say, give them coffee? But they really want water. Well, they want water because of me. On me, I am I. I am not them. Right? I am the son, I'm not the father. Sure, as a father, I understand that you want your son to give you water because you don't want to bother them. But I'm not him, I'm I. And as I'm going to give him what I think it's you like more. Right? Not taking in consideration my being bothered because I, over myself, I have control. Therefore, I'll give you coffee and not water. He said, no, 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 but I want water. No, coffee. Dear. The idea being that after all is said and done, right, I am not my father. And I, as the son, can choose to give you what I say is something that you like more, right? Without taking consideration what you think about my being bothered. So, he says, with this, we can understand the following apparent contradiction. Now, again, there is a danger of oversimplification in this question, but I'll tell it to you anyway, because the answer is very, very fitting. There's an apparent contradiction concerning the purpose of the creation of man, such a simple matter as the purpose of the creation of man in this world. There is a statement in the Talmud which says the following. Why did God create man? Because God is essentially good. And as good requires, the good requires to give. Giving is an outcome of being good. So God has to give. So he has to be, create a recipient of his goodness. Obviously, he had to give the human being, the recipient, free will. Because otherwise, there is a flaw in the giving. Because you can compare it to the giving of a beggar. So, but if you earn what I give you, then there is a fulfillment. There is something complete. There is something perfect in the giving. So therefore, God had to give the recipient free will in order that he should earn what God wants to give him. Okay? So, would it be a correct statement to say that God created man in order to give him reward? Is that a correct statement as an outcome, as the conclusion of this statement in the Talmud? Yes, obviously. That is the purpose. Okay? How would you understand the fact that it says in another place in the Talmud that if a person does anything, any mitzvah, he should never think of the reward? Don't be like the servant who serves the master in order to get reward. Be like the servant who doesn't even take in consideration the reward. Reward means nothing. What do you mean reward means nothing? Reward is the purpose of why God created me. So why shouldn't I do things in order to get reward? Isn't that, after all, why God created me? Okay.
It's the same analogy of the son and the father with the coffee and the water.
That's exactly it. That's what Reb Chaim of Volozhin says. Exactly, that is the analogy, he says. In the eyes of God, why did he create us? That we should get reward. But I am not God. Right. If I were God, of course, I would also say, I want to create creatures in order they should reach. But I'm not God. But so I, as a servant of God, I'm going to do things because he wants them, not because I'm going to get reward. Is there a contradiction? Sure, that's the contradiction of the fact that I am I and God is God. I am not God. Okay? Therefore, he says, why is it? Let me just add, there are many, many things that this concept answers. You know that it says that when God commanded the Jews to build the tabernacle, God tells them to build the utensils first. Build the menorah, build the altar, build this, build that. And afterwards, at the end, build the tent. What is it called in Hebrew, the tent? Mishkon, the Mishkon. Build the Mishkon at the end. When the architect came, he changed the order. No more and no less. He decided to build the Mishkan, the tent first, and then to build the utensils inside. So Moshe Rabbeinu asks him, didn't I tell you the opposite order? So he says, well, yeah, but you know, that's the way we build houses here. First we build the outside and then we buy the furniture. So Moshe says, you know exactly what's the right way to do things. You were in that's the way you put it, in the shadow of God. In other words, when you are in the shadow of somebody, you know exactly the movements of that person. And by the way, the name of the architect is Bezalel, which means Bezalel Kael, in the shadow of God. You really know what God wants. What's going on? If that's what God wants, let God say first the tent and then the utensils, then the Kaelim. The answer is, as far as God is concerned, what's his main concern? What we do, that we should get rewards. The instrument represents what we do. The Mishkan represents what he is to us. So as far as we are concerned, what's our goal? The Shekhinah, the presence of God, the Mishkan. That's why we build the tent first. As far as God is concerned, the Kelim, the instruments are first, because he wants us to get reward. Says Reb Chaim of Volozhin, the same goes with Passover and the holiday of the Matzah. When God stresses, you know what is the name of the holiday? Chag HaMatzos, Chag HaMitzvos. Why? Who is he focusing on? On what we do, on the mitzvos, on the reward. But we, right, as good sons, we say, forget about that, God. You know what's the main point in the holiday? You skipped us over. You care about us. Oh, so what do we call it? We don't listen to the Torah. We say, Chag Ham Pesach, we say, you skipped over us. That's the main goal, right? Because after all, you are God and we are just human beings. So we will call it Pesach and we won't call it Chag HaMatzos. That's what Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin says. Now, just one more idea, a short insight again of the Maharal of Rai. Take a look at the next portion, which is already the introduction to the first two paragraphs of the Hallel, of the Song of Praise. We take the cup, because it's already the conclusion, so again we take the cup in our hands and we say, Lefichach, therefore, Anachnu chayavim lehodot. We owe you, thank you. We owe it to you. Lehodot lehalei leshabeach lefoer leromeim lehader leborech lehalei ulkaleis. Now, depends. You may have a different version here. There are some who have an added word, which is lenatzeach, which is also a type of praise. Those are all synonyms of the word praise. How many synonyms do you find here? If you have a Haggadah Nusach Ashkenaz, you will find 9. If you have an Haggadah Nusach Sfar, you'll find 10. Right? Says the Maharal of Prague. But even the Ashkenazi Haggadot with 9, they rely on the last word of the paragraph, Hallelujah, which is the 10th. So no matter what, no matter which version you have, the key number here is the number 10, he says. Right? So therefore, don't worry about the two versions, he says. Both are focusing on the number 10. Why are they focusing on the number 10? So he makes the very, very strange remark, because we say 10 reasons why we have to show appreciation. Let's read the whole portion after we said the 9 or the 10 synonyms for praise. Lemi she'asa lavoteinu velanu et kol hanisim ha'el. After all, you did to us so many miracles. How many miracles? Hotzianu me'avdut lecheirut. You took us out from slavery to freedom. Me'yagon lesimcha. From sadness to happiness. May Eveliyonto, from mourning to a holiday. May Afeilo Leorgodol, from darkness to light. Umishibud Legulaim, from slavery to redemption, to freedom. So he says, how many reasons are there to praise God? You say 5. How does he come to number 10? The Maharal says, therefore, he says, you see that there are 10 reasons to show appreciation. But you are right, I came to the same question. I say, what is he talking about? If he's, you hear, from sadness to happiness, so how many reasons do you have to thank him? Only one? Obviously, he's counting as two, right? And from slavery to freedom, obviously, he's counting it as two, otherwise he couldn't get the number 10. But the Maharal is 100% consistent with something which he says something somewhere else. And I explain that with the following analogy. Let's say, for instance, a person has an accident, right? Let's say somebody pushes him, he falls down, breaks his leg. Terrible tragedy, right? Terrible thing. So he's very sad. So he ends up in the hospital and he has to stay there for 2 weeks. All right? Now, let's say that in the hospital, next bed, somebody's lying there, and he becomes a good friend of this person. And this person comes out, owns a company, and he hires him. And he had a terrible problem finding a job, right? And all of a sudden, he has a job offered to him. And after a few years, he becomes a multimillionaire, right? And then he thinks back and he says, was it such a tragedy, the fact that I fell down and broke my leg in retrospect? Now that I see the outcome, even the breaking of the leg is a good thing. At the time, I didn't know it, right? So therefore, now I'm not only going to be appreciative for the fact that he gave me a job. I even have to be appreciative from the fact that I fell down, that at the time I didn't know the goodness that will come out of it. In other words, after a while, you appreciate, right, even the bad things, that because the bad things were just like an introduction to the good things. Now, we know that everything that the Jews went through, or everything that the Jews are going through, we believe, we don't see it, because we aren't on the other side yet. But once you are on the other side, you start appreciating what brought you to that side. So therefore, it's 100% consistent with this idea that Maharal is saying here. When you say, me'avdus lecheirus, from slavery to freedom. So what do we thank God for? You say freedom? No. Once we are free, we recognize that the freedom is good. But I wouldn't have come to the recognition that freedom is good unless I went through slavery. So therefore, how many reasons for appreciation are there? 10 and not 5. This is why there are 10 synonyms for appreciation. Okay. If anybody's interested in davening mincha.